Hey there, welcome back to the TV podcast. I'm your host, Evan Higgins, one-fifth of the troop known as the Broken Boys, and we are back with episodes 4 and 5 of season 1 of Altered Carbon. We're a couple of Broken Boys down this week, but I do have at the ready my trusty sidekicks of Eric Scott and Jason Johnson.
So, what holiday is coming up next this week?
We'll have to ask Poe, because he's the head honcho on all that. So, we do have 2 episodes to get to over the course of this next hour, and we do apologize for the delay on getting a new episode of this up. It's been a weird couple of weeks for a lot of us, and obviously that goes without saying for a great many of you listeners out there, but we definitely appreciate you guys taking the time to give us a listen. And with that, we will jump into the synopsis / recap for episode 4, which is called Force of Evil. When we left Takeshi Kovacs at the end of episode 3, he had been apprehended by people we weren't sure about. We start this episode finding out that he's been abducted to a medical facility, and he proceeds to be tortured over the course of the episode by the other side of the sleeve jacker known as Dimmy the Twin. And he has to remember his envoy training taught to him by Calcris Falconer to try and turn the tables on his captors. Meanwhile, Poe, the AI, is continuing to try and rehabilitate Lizzie despite her father Vernon's objections. Detective Ortega is investigating more into the man she saw at the party and only finds evidence of what they dub a ghost walker, because the mustachioed man does not appear on any camera anywhere in Lawrence Bancroft's facility, which is quite a trick. She then trades a thug stack at the police station for her grandmother's to celebrate the Day of the Dead, which happens through the course of this episode, with her family, which causes a bit of, shall we say, consternation with her mom and her other relatives. Kovacs manages to break out of the facility and takes down the other Dimmy the Twin, and Garcia meets him back at the Raven, where he wants to know who Riker is and why she was tracking him. Fast forward to episode 5, called The Wrong Man, where Kovacs learns that his sleeve is the former disgraced cop Elias Riker, who was also Ortega's partner and ex-lover, and he would like some answers. Miriam Bancroft then offers Kovacs money in exchange for him dropping the case, which he obviously refuses. He then finds Lawrence Bancroft donating goods and talking to refugees down at the ground level, infected by a contagion bomb that kills his sleeve in front of everybody in a grand theatrical display. Poe tells Kovacs that Lawrence was at the fight drome the night he died, and he finds the previous sleeve in one of the cryo tubes that we saw in episode 1. He also finds Isaac Bancroft was at the fight drome, and Lawrence assaulted him there, and it turns out Isaac made his own sleeve of his father to impersonate him to make a deal with the Japanese. Ortega then interrogates Dimmy the Twin using the same sleeve she put her grandmother in, but then is attacked by the ghost walker in the elevator, who also kills Samir and apprehends Dimmy, and that is where we leave Takeshi at the end of episode 5. So, gents, I will turn it over to you. What do we like and not like about episode 4? Because there's a lot going on in it that gives you a lot of insight into where Takeshi came from and what he's capable of, and also gives a bit more world building and a bit more structure to what is happening around him with the supporting characters in Poe and Ortega.
I think episode 4 is definitely my favorite of the 5 we've covered so far. I really like the juxtaposition of jumping back and forth between his training on how to handle the interrogation and the interrogation itself. I think they made a lot of progress in showing the envoy stuff there. And as was pointed out by, I think, Eric, the icons used in the interrogation technology was a nice juxtaposition to the grisly nature of Dimmy's interrogation.
Yeah, as a person who used to build UIs for work, I do like appreciate the little cutesy icons for like things. So you have the cutesy little torture icon, flame icon when he's there burning his limbs off, and it's just kind of funny, in a kind of perverse way. But
yeah, there was one that I remember, like when Dimmy told the tech guys to bust out like the heavy guns, They had an experimental one that they had gotten, I think they said from China, I think. And it was, the icon was a gift box. It was like, here's your surprise. And you open it up, and it was that bug thing that they subjected Kovacs to. It was the last thing they tried to break him with.
I was having flashbacks to the Matrix.
Yeah, it's kind of like a little game, too, where like the first one where they got the pliers was like, you know, level one. And then it was like, you know, level seven was the fire. And then it's like, you know, they're going up the different levels of torture, you know, the different degrees.
Right. And there is the classic trope in shows like this and in most stories like this, that once you get to a point where a character's being tortured in any respect, that we'd like to think that they're going to be able to find a way to hold out and withstand it. And I appreciated how they made it really clear up front that in this world, you're not going to have that luxury. Every Falconer makes it very clear in the flashback to when she's with the other envoys training Takeshi and his sister, who we see, but she doesn't have any real role in this, that everybody breaks eventually. They will find a way to break you because that's the whole point of it. But the interesting thing is what your mind will do to try and fend for itself until it inevitably breaks. And the trick she teaches him is finding a way to use that defense mechanism that's ingrained in your brain chemistry to manipulate the situation to your advantage. And that's how you get the torture to end. But that's not going to be easy. And we see what happens when she runs Takeshi through the simulations and she's got him like chained up in a bathroom and she's having her way with him and there's SeaTac agents there and everything. And we see him stripping it all down, but that takes him time to figure out how to manipulate it and how to change the state of play to give him that advantage. That's the whole point of the envoy training.
Yeah, and to Jason's point, it is like the Matrix, where you know you learn somehow to eventually you know control the simulation to you know break out of the programming and kind of make your own programming.
And the whole trick that he has to do is maintain the illusion that he's you know not in control until he's ready to enact it and has basically convinced Demi that he's vulnerable, and that's when he can flip the cards on him. So.
Yeah, because he was still trying to play off that he was the sex worker's mom, still trying to look for her, and then you know he's trying to play that off to throw him off, and that didn't work out too long. But yeah, he was trying the different techniques to hang in there until he could figure out how to break out.
Well, and Demi's flaw, and we found this out in episode one when he shows up the Raven, when the other version of him shows up the Raven and gets killed there. Beating up Takeshi is he assumes that the guy he's trying to get the information from that he's torturing is Elias Riker, not understanding that the sleeve in or the stack inside the sleeve is Takeshi Kovacs. And because of that, Demi overestimates what he can do and what it ultimately does. That doesn't mean that Takeshi doesn't get the crap beat out of him and doesn't go through hell in this episode. Because like you said, they start level one is his getting his fingernails pulled out with pliers. That, as far as level one, is already skipping some levels. But we see him get shot in the head. That's pretty much the most humane one, and I think that was level two. Then you see him get set on fire, his legs get burned off and hacked off, and then they bust out the big gun with the Matrix-like bug. But it also reminded me a little bit of Edge of Tomorrow, where it doesn't just happen once. It's you die, they rewind you, and you have to go through something different all over again. So if you think about how many layers they can stack on top of you in that virtual simulation world of torturing you eight ways till Sunday, it stands to reason that you're only going to be able to handle so much of it. Even if you can get past level one, level two is probably going to break you 50% quicker than you would think it would. But again, going back to what Falconer had trained him to do and understanding how to, looking at it from almost like a chess game of, okay, well, Demi's going to do this. I need to be able to withstand it and counter this way. and then get to a point where I can really flip the script on him. And when he does, that scene where he finally comes to on the table in the facility and the techs are looking at him like, are you, wait a minute, this isn't normal. And then it's that line of, well, you know, who are you? And he goes, somebody you truly should not have effed with. And I liked how they had his hallucination of Falconer there standing behind them as he's just rattling off what he's going to do and what is going to happen to them as they understand who they are dealing with. And they don't come out and he doesn't come out and say, I'm Takeshi Kovacs, I'm an envoy, and I'm going to kill you in about 2 minutes. He goes by the fact that he was a former SeaTac officer, and he can utilize that aspect of his experience to really drive home the fact of what is going to happen to these people. And the whole time, Falconer's sitting there going, yep, keep ramp it up, keep going. And when the guys all of a sudden look at each other and like, oh, we're screwed. And then he makes it to his bag and gets the guns out. It was like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, because that was part of the training, too, is he said, when you get back to reality, you know, you have to be ready. Because, yeah, I mean, he escaped from being, you know, tied down to the table in VR. But then when he gets out to the real world, he's still tied down to a table. So it's like, you still, okay, that's part one. You know, now you have to finish, you know, now you have to get free, and you can't get free by yourself. So, yeah, you start putting the mind, you know, mind games on the guys to be like, okay, you know who you're dealing with here? You know, if you don't let me go, you know, it's going to be really bad. And sure enough, the one guy's like, okay, screw it, we're out of here. Let him go. We're gone. And then,
yeah, and he makes it really clear. Was it first guy that comes to help me lives?
Yeah.
Other two guys, not so sure.
I get the stacks blown out, yeah. So.
And he also really quickly, was able to analyze what was actually going on in the room and use that knowledge as if he knew what they were doing beforehand, where they were harvesting the body parts and doing all that kind of stuff. The other thing I wanted to mention was one of the during the simulation torture, you get a good viewpoint of the split stack damage that Demi has by being a twin, right? Because he can't maintain his personality manifestation, his who he thinks he is in the virtual world. He keeps flipping between the skin, the I'm blanking on my terms here. Sleeve. Thank you. That did not come to me. The sleeve that he's currently wearing to the one his brother had to probably some ones they've worn in the past and just bouncing all back and forth. He can't maintain.
Right. And Riker points that out to him of because of what Demi has done and the long-term damage that's going to have. And then, yeah, when you see him start to glitch that way, it was off-putting when you realize, oh, wait a minute, he's not entirely there because of what he's done to get himself into this position. And now he's trying to figure out what's going on, knowing full well that the other side of him is already dead.
Yeah, because they've mentioned before in previous episodes that unless you're going into like basically your same body, which only the meths can afford to go into your same basic clone, basically your same DNA, that it slowly wears on you and you get more and more, you know, I guess crazy. And if you're this guy who's bouncing around between bodies and, you know, doing dual sleeving or more than that, who knows, that, you know, he's on the fast track for psychosis.
Right. It's the same premise of, and I know I'm dating myself here, but kids, once upon a time, there wasn't such a thing as a DVR. If we wanted to be able to get media for anything, we had to use something called a VCR, which had these big tapes that you put in it and you record stuff that way. Well, one of the nice things was, is when you did that, you could hook up another VCR to it and do the same thing. The problem is that when you did that, it lost a little bit of quality when you transferred it from one tape to the other. That's a 1980s way of saying that's exactly what happens in this story. So if you're not sure, ask your parents. The first thing they'll tell you is you couldn't program a clock on a VCR, but we digress. So that out of the way, what else do we think about this episode? Because we did get a little bit more information about the mystery man at the party, although not much. You know, what we find out is that the police are able to determine that somebody was there, but they only figure it out by manipulating the footage that they see to realize that whoever it is has the ability to truly cloak themselves and be invisible which they find more than a little off-putting.
So my question on that technology, and I didn't quite get it from the episode, but maybe I just missed it, is it masking him in real time from the footage, or is it being deleted from the footage afterwards?
I wasn't entirely sure about that myself. I know that the reason why they were able to identify that he was there was they said they were able to adjust the footage to track the air currents that creates the visual distortion that goes, oh, somebody's there. It's like in Star Trek, wherever you had a cloaked Klingon ship, where you get that shimmer and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, there it goes. That's what they were able to discern from the footage. But I don't genuinely remember if he was able to completely doctor himself out of it, or if it's just that he has essentially a cloaking system that lets him move unimpeded and undetected through situations like that.
Yeah, because it first looked like when they're at the party in real time, like looking through her eyes, not the video, that she looked at, she saw him, and then she looked back later and he was gone. So did he really cloak himself physically, or just was like sneaky and walked away? Now it looks like it's more just only invisibility towards machines, like towards videoing or to taping, because it's probably real time.
Right, or you could proffer to say that whatever technology he has, it has a functionality range on it. Like, he can only be cloaked, for lack of a better term, for 5 minutes, and then he's got to decloak to be able to recharge it for, like, 30 seconds, which allowed Ortega to see him. I'm not sure. They don't spend a lot of time dwelling on it, and if they had, I think that would have dragged the episode down, because we're totally dealing in technobabble.
Yeah, and it's not really important to, like, I guess the grand scheme of things. Because obviously, he won't show up on sensors or on surveillance. Kind of like a vampire can't be seen in mirrors. Like, you know, can't see their own reflection kind of deal. But it's not like a plot, at least right now, it's not like a plot device, like a plot, you know, essentials of the plot.
Right. I just was wondering if maybe, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but in the police station, if he would show up in their cameras, or if it's an access thing where somebody was able to go behind him in that previous instance. So,
right. All we know is that he has the ability to move around in a way that even a meth as powerful as Lawrence Bancroft can't track, which, given what we have seen about his capabilities as a meth, that's a frightening concept, because you would think that somebody with his clout and his power would have the means to subvert that. But if he doesn't, then that adds a dangerous new player onto the board that obviously concerns Ortega. Speaking of, she has a lot to do in this episode, but not a lot of it has to really do with Kovach. And she goes in a direction that I wasn't anticipating, but I appreciate the fact that we got a little bit of levity in this episode with what she does to celebrate the Day of the Dead with her grandma and her family. What'd you guys think of that?
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement that we kind of liked that plot line. It was just a nice break from the heaviness, and just to get, like, here's people's day-to-day lives and the conflict that we can get into that we'll talk about with, you know, half the family is like the neo-Catholics don't want, you know, grandma, you know, brought back to talk to her. Others, you know, the kids seem to have no problem with it. They're like, hey, grandma, like, you know, it's this big tattooed, like, biker dude, and it's like, it's grandma, you know. It's just
right. Who, when we're introduced to him, he's there in the station having gotten pulled in by a couple of blue shirts, and he's arguing up a storm, and he gets in Ortega's face, and Ortega pulls out one of the guy's stun batons and zaps him. And then only after Samir comes over and says, hey, don't forget about, you know, the party tonight for the Day of the Dead. She's like, yeah, I'll be there. And then she has to remember the fact of, oh, by the way, I need a sleeve to put grandma in. Which, going back to episode one, we know that sleeves, while the meths can cultivate their own, and then if you can afford it, you can get pretty much any sleeve you want. For the rank and file people in this world, you take what is available. Which Ortega, you would think, being a detective and a police officer, would have some level of clout that she'd be able to get a better sleeve, but she's got to make do with what she's got, and what she's got is this guy she zapped, this hulking 6 foot, 240-odd pound guy with a spiderweb tattoo on the side of his bald head, a big old bushy beard. He's not the sort of person you would think they would bring home and go, hey, grandma's here.
But that actor sells it, and I want to say that he's definitely one of the highlights of these two episodes because his personality changes and the way he manifests those characters is amazing.
Yeah, even his accents, like he had the, you know, Spanish accent, you know, for the when he's abuela and talking to his you know family, and then he had the I guess Russian or Eastern European accent when he was Demi. Yeah.
Right, and Jason, I'm glad you brought that up because that was the key to it. And I don't know the actor's name offhand, but yeah, his ability to shift like that was what sustained the believability of it. That you see him go from this drunken, just Neanderthal troglodyte to being essentially a sweet old lady in a body that's not hers. And that point where I think they were at the station and she asks Ortega, do you guys have any drugs in the evidence locker that we can use? And Ortega, of course, is obviously against this. And she's like, what? I've never tried it before. What do you want me to do?
Yeah, and it's not her body, so what the heck, right? You know,
right. But it also brings up an interesting point because that conversation they have at the end between Ortega and her grandmother, I thought was really interesting. And again, the writers didn't have to throw that in there. But with the whole concept of the religious side of this society that is against the stacks and against re-sleeving and everything that represents, and the people who obviously utilize it for commerce, convenience, life, everything, how that intertwines, and even in a functional family level, the little bit of tension that can build between it when grandma tells Ortega, look, you don't need to spin me up again. I'm good being gone. And you see the kind of the conflict in Ortega where she doesn't want to, but at the same time, she also understands that she's got to honor her grandmother's wishes, even though she knows what that means in a world where she can just spin her up in another stack next year and they can have another conversation.
And you, as you alluded to, even for the common man, even outside of the religion, the NEOCs, you know, sometimes they just don't want to come back. And that's outside of religion, that's an interesting approach because everyone else is kind of pushing it heavy.
Yeah, because you don't know what being another body looks like, because obviously they made the joke about, you know, I'm peeing standing up, you know, and you know, they made fun of it. But yeah, I mean, you would have to get used to, you know, new bodies, new physiology, and
well, we had
it would wear on you just in general anyway, not the fact that you might eventually start getting psychosis and weird things, but
and we had the little girl come back in the first episode in the old lady's body, you know, as an example. So
right. And it speaks to the overriding theme of this series and the overriding concept of, is immortality really worth it? And if you have the opportunity to be truly immortal, thanks to the stacks and your ability to re-sleeve, how long do you go before you realize that it's maybe not worth it? And not even so much in the, you know, I've lived X number of years, I've lived X number of lifetimes, I've seen all these incredible things, but one day you wake up and you go, I'm fine resting now, you know, which we all grapple with. It's the whole idea of, you know, it runs counter to us as human beings to say, well, no, we have to survive, we have to carry on, we have to go as long as we can, because we understand on multiple levels that, you know, and religious perspectives aside, and I'm not saying one is right, one is wrong, that's not the whole basis of this, but just the idea of we, at a fundamental level, recognize that you get X number of years, and that's it. And if you can transcend that, like they do in Altered Carbon, how long do you go before you start reverting back to the idea of, I've lived too long, or this isn't worth it anymore, or, you know, the world's moved on to a point where I can't survive in this, or I don't want to live in it. Which, and again, they don't spend a lot of time harping on all this stuff, but the more you watch the show and the more you get into the world that has been built in it, the more you realize these characters are grappling with it in to one degree or another. At least it seems to me.
Yeah, no, I like that. You know, they're pulling back the curtain. It's not just here's the story arc. Let's just go for it. They're giving you exposure to here's the world we've created. Here's the issues that could happen. Here's the things that could happen. And even Dimmy, in the next episode, even starts talking about basically at this point, it's all down to just your experiences. Because, you know, if you can live forever or live longer than one life, it's just, okay, what new things can I do to not be bored, not be whatever, and, you know, and then, yeah, to, like, grandma's point, it's like, I'm old, I've done what I need to do, I'm done, I don't need to do this anymore. You know, I've done a good life, I'm okay. Yeah.
Right, and you juxtapose that with, and they, again, it's only touched on in the early part of episode four, and we don't see her in this episode, it's more implied than shown. But what Poe is still trying to do with Lizzie, who, for people who are coming into this midstream, and if you are, what are you doing? Go back and watch it and come back. We'll still be here. But that he is trying to rebuild Lizzie's psyche after she has been stuck in that damaged stack for so long. And then you have her father, Vernon, trying to kind of push his way in under his fatherly prerogative of, I need to help my daughter. I don't trust that what Poe is doing, and Poe being an AI in a world where AIs aren't seen very profitably or very charitably, he's not trusting a Poe to be able to know what he can do to help his daughter out. But again, Poe is pushing back against him, saying, look, what you did didn't work. And if you want your daughter back, if you want your daughter back whole, and if you want her back healed, you've got to let this play out. And of course, Vernon isn't liking that.
Yeah, and I think I guess it's a weak, I won't even call it a weakness, because there's a lot of characters they have to give screen time to, but these two episodes don't really give him a lot to do, right? I mean, he's at the bar Raven, and then he does make a attempt to rescue Kovacs, but it's, you know, he's already, of course, out by the time he gets to the facility, and then he just kind of sits around for the rest of the other episodes. So there's not a lot for Vernon to do in these two episodes.
Yeah, they do have to put him on a shelf for right now, which I did feel bad about after we saw him being more active in episode three. But I would assume, and as we transition to episode five, by the time we get to the end of episode five, I know that we're going to likely see him be more active going forward in episode six at least. So anything else about episode four stand out to you? One thing I did like that we hadn't touched on was, or at least a little bit, when he does break out, how that facility that Kovac was stuck in, how clean and sterile it was when he was brought in. And I liked the directorial decision to make it very much not so by the time he got out. Because
yeah, and he just didn't care about anybody else in that facility. If you're in that facility, you're guilty of whatever, organ harvesting, torture, whatever. Everyone's dead. He just mowed everybody down.
Guilt by association, for sure.
You could be like an accountant, maybe one of the janitors. Didn't matter. Just take everybody out.
Yeah, totally. And it also, going back and rewatching it again this time, I forgot about the fact that as he's there being interrogated and tortured, they show over on the, I guess I want to say the autopsy or harvesting table, was the girl from the strip club that he had been talking to, that he had been posing as her mother. Because we see that blonde wig on the ground, which she had been wearing at the time.
Okay, I was wondering if that was the same person, but yeah, okay, now that makes sense. Yeah,
yeah, I'm 99% sure if it was, and if not, I will make sure to issue a correction on it when we come back for episode six. But I'm pretty sure that was her. So, you know, that gives him even more incentive to be a little bit more ruthless when he gets up and moving. I do also dig that gun he has that fires the bullet and then retracts it back into the bottom barrel. I would love to be able to play like a first-person shooter with that.
It definitely saves on ammo cost.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we got to see it in use as he, you know, recalled the bullet through one of the techs. So, okay, yep, there's Chekhov's gun. We saw it two episodes ago, and now we got to see it for real.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hello Unicorn backpack makes another appearance, maybe for the last time, who knows. But I guess they couldn't get the Hello Kitty people to give them the license for that. But.
No, they definitely could not. But I do, that is a nice style touch, that for a guy as big and badass as Kovach / Riker is, that he is still walking around with that backpack that he got in episode one. Because in episode one, that had all the drugs he was going to take that one night he was here before he was going to go back on ice. And now that it's his all-purpose bag, it's, I could see him walking down the street somewhere, a guy as big as Joel Kinnaman is, in that show, and people giving him like double takes of, is that, holy crap, is it a Hello Unicorn thing on his back?
Which just leaves some more confusion of why they couldn't get the licensing. I don't know. Yeah. But
he probably won't be associated with the kitty happy fun mascot to like drugs and murder and
Well, and keep in mind this is 250 odd years in the future. We don't know for sure if Hello Kitty's going to be around that long. I will say right now, I'd give it the over under it 35% chance that it would. Because Hello Kitty is a truly immortal thing, but
just like all restaurants will be Taco Bell.
Exactly. Yes. But we're not going to get into the shells again. So episode 5 begins with Garcia, Ortega and Riker / Takeshi back at the Raven. And Takeshi is putting the pieces together and figuring out why it is that she was interested in him from the beginning, and it had nothing to do with the fact that he is Takeshi Kovach. It also gives us a payoff to a bit of a throwaway line in episode 1 where they were having drinks together and she's explaining why she had looked into Bancroft's claims that he was murdered, found out that there was no case there, and she says to Takeshi, well, because of that, Bancroft has decided to screw with me, and he still is. At the time, we didn't understand what that meant. By the time episode 4 ends and episode 5 starts, that's made much clearer. Because Lawrence, to pry at Ortega a bit, chose the one person she didn't want to get damaged, being Elias Riker's sleeve, and put Kovach in it. Which, to me, speaks a bit more about the Machiavellian nature of Lawrence Bancroft, which we see a lot of in this episode. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I was really hung up on that, too, and the fact that for somebody who has spent a lot of money to bring Kovach back and have him investigate, he seems to be letting all of his petty asides to cloud that and complicate it to where I don't know how he thinks it'll ever succeed.
Yeah, plus, I mean, I'm sure he knows the Riker's case file, like why he's there, what happened, and that whether or not he did himself or he was set up, he would figure that also bringing him back, anybody that was involved in that would be looking for him as well, not just people out to stop him from investigating Lauren's issue. So, yeah, I mean, he's, you know, being the colossal dick that he is, but then he can be because he's one of the most powerful people on the planet, and, you know, if you mess with him, he's going to find little ways to shove it back in your face.
Yeah, and I appreciated how we see Takeshi start to piece everything together. You know, at the end of episode 4, he's asking Ortega, who is Riker? And of course, she doesn't want to answer because she doesn't want to reveal her hand to him. And he starts going through it, going, well, when I was getting tortured by Dimmy, he kept saying I was Riker. Except he didn't know I was Riker. Or at least he didn't know who I was inside of Riker. So that means that there's something about this guy that is important to him, which is important to you. And then when Dimmy tells him, as he's starting to be tortured, hey, we found this tracker on you, but it happened to be put in with that broadcast emitter that Ortega slapped onto his neck in episode 1. So how would Takeshi know it was there? And when he finds that out, you see Takeshi's eyes go up. It's like, wait a minute, I was being tracked, but not by you. Okay, who was tracking me? And then we also have a little bit of a clip in episode 4 where Mickey, the tech guy, the talking dog, or the tin dog, I should say, was reminding Ortega, hey, you know that tracking package that we gave you, that Hawkeye system? People are asking where that went. I'm going to need that back soon. So we are getting the subtext now of how Ortega has been making sure that she can follow Takeshi every step of the way because she needs to make sure that his sleeve stays intact so she can get her partner slash boyfriend back, which Takeshi isn't very thrilled about.
So here's what I just thought of, which maybe I missed it in this episode or the last one, but in the first episode, when the first Demi is in the Raven, he calls Riker Kovach, so he knows it's not Riker. So did that not make it to his twin? Like, obviously that they're different, the stacks are separate, so they don't share memories. So did he not obviously have time to tell the other guy, oh, by the way, this isn't Riker? Because the second one thinks it is Riker. So
evidently.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I was to make sure I wasn't missing something.
Right.
There.
Yeah. I would have to go back and double check that. And it's been so long since we did episode 1 that I'm not entirely sure. But I thought the original Demi thought he was Riker too. But.
No, I took it away that he thought he was Kovach as well.
Because he said Kovach.
No, that's right.
The second one was left out.
The first one, because he's like, how you know I'm Kovach? Like, no one knows I'm here on this planet. Like, you know.
Right. And Demi chides him a little bit, saying, hey, I know you were an envoy, and I thought you'd be bigger and badder and all this stuff, and you don't look like much to me. So, yeah, it's somewhere along the way between the twins, there was a disconnect between who was who in who was occupying the sleeve of Elias Riker.
Yeah, or you found out about it, and just before you could tell anybody, you know, that's when, you know, the hotel, you know, shot him to pieces, and, you know, so,
where Poe took it a bit too far. But we also see a bit of background on Elias Riker himself at the beginning of this episode, because he's still trying to figure out what happened to the woman we saw in episode 2 who fell out of the sky and landed in the lake. And we also find out that she, I guess at one point, had been a friend of Riker's, which is why he was so hell-bent on finding out who killed her or why she died.
Yeah, and he was not the most reliable interviewer, but from the interrogation, you know, he definitely was pursuing that case with fervor.
Yeah, it was getting somewhere definitely before he got pulled away from it, like trying to figure out, you know, that she wasn't neo-Catholic, but she was coded that the guy said no, he was coded that way, and that does start leading into possible other issues or questions or, you know, plot elements going forward, which I thought was interesting.
Right, and if I remember right, the guy he's interrogating is a SeaTac guy, which Riker, as we find out from Demi, had been framed by Demi for killing a SeaTac officer. So we're seeing everything start to get lined up here as we're moving into the second half of this first season to see, okay, this is where everybody started from. This is what has been done to put Riker in this position where he's on ice that allows Kovach to come back as Riker, and he's figuring out what happened to him along with Ortega and how that's tying into what's happening with Takeshi's investigation of who wants to kill Lawrence Bancroft. So we're seeing the web starting to branch out a little bit and more threads getting tied together. I will admit, it's in a slightly convoluted way, but you've got to be able to do that sometimes if you're going to want to make a story this big in kind of this scale.
Yeah, they're being very successful because I still haven't seen the spider, but it's definitely, you know, at least more, we know more now than we did 4 episodes ago.
Yeah, it keeps you interested, and it bounces around, and it, you know, you think one thing, and then maybe not, you know. So it's good at that, keeping you suspense.
Well, and you say that, Jason, we haven't seen the spider yet, but in this episode especially, we get hints of who it might be, because after he has the has it out with Ortega. And I do like the fact that while they're arguing, the head of Dimmy the Twin is sitting in an ice bucket in the middle of his room, and he's like, here, you want answers? Talk to him. And he just lobs the head at Ortega, and she ends up walking out of the hotel with it, and both Poe and Vernon are like, what the hell's don't ask.
It was funny when she was getting ready to leave, and she's like, oh, I probably just can't walk down the street with a severed head. Let me, and then Poe's like, that's an expensive linen. You'll get dry cleaned, right? Professional dry clean.
Leave it to Poe to have the perfect amount of levity in an otherwise tense standoff. So, but, Takeshi goes back to the Erie and is met by Miriam Bancroft, who gives him the proposition of, give up on the case now, and I'll set you up. And not only will I set you up financially, I'll set you up because I have my own clones or my own sleeves. And she even takes it in a really twisted way, and we see this visually implied, of how she said she lets her, every so often she goes to the facility and decants her sleeves, meaning, or at least implying, that she takes them all out of stasis and kind of lets them have fun with each other? What?
Yeah, and maybe some of the hiring staff, which we saw kind of in the one episode, so who knows? Yeah, there's lots of decadence going on with Mrs. Bancroft there.
Right, and as we know, Takeshi has already slept with Miriam once. We saw that in episode 2, if I recall. That she knows she can get to him based on how her sleeve is constructed, literally. And we see him pulling back on that and was like, no. No, you fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you got another thing coming.
Yeah, and now he's committed to finding out what's going on now, so there's no way he's going to be like, okay, sure, let's go, have fun. He's, you've piqued the envoy's curiosity now, and he's going to see it through the end now.
And he makes it clear that his goal is to freedom, and, he's going to pursue this until he gets out of it what he needs to get out of it to get out.
Exactly. And then the next time we see him, he's down on the ground level with Lawrence, where Lawrence is acting very much like the philanthropist, prophet,
Messiah.
Yeah, demigod that he believes he is in dealing with these refugees and these people who we find out in the course of the conversation, they are the descendants, I don't want to say the ancestors of, but their ancestors were on a colony that was hit by what they called a contagion bomb. And they are all infected. They aren't all showing lethal signs of it, but as Takeshi is talking with Bancroft is really quickly becoming infected, then being overpowered by it, and then dies from it. But as Kovacs points out, what he's doing is not malevolence, it's theater. Because as he's doing all this, we see the little drones flying around recording all of it. So to him, this is an exercise to show, well, I still remember the little people, and I'm doing something to help the little people with all my great powers of meth. And Kovacs calls him out on it. Well, if you have all this power, then why don't you just get these people new sleeves? And Lawrence basically says, you're missing the point.
Yeah, I found a lot of irony in the fact that these people need new sleeves, and instead of bothering to do that, he destroys a perfectly good sleeve for theater.
Yeah, it's like, I'm doing my, little PR bit. Look, all mess are good. We care for the little people. But also, as we might talk about later with the Ghostwalker guy, this might seem like, to our point in a couple episodes ago of, mess think themselves as gods. So he's out there, coming down to the unwashed masses, giving them little gifts and helping their little pitiful existences. But then it kills him. But then, this probably isn't the first time he's done this. So then he comes back. It's like, look, he rose from the dead and came back to us. And so is he looking for, worship? Is he looking for, power trip, who knows, right?
Yeah, it speaks a lot to the amalgamation of so much power, both financial power and biological power, by having the ability to have so many variations of yourself that you can go down there and just jettison one of them at your discretion to put on a show. You know, that speaks to our earlier conversation about the whole nature of the stacks and what that represents for both sides, where you see somebody with Bancroft's clout openly flaunting it, brazenly flaunting it, going, look, I know these people are going to kill me, and I know I'm handing them trinkets and a pittance of what I can actually do. But in the end, it's going to make me look better. It's going to make them feel like there's an order to all this. Because like you said, Eric, there's going to be another version of me coming back in X amount of time, and we're going to repeat this charade all over again. And they're going to be fine.
And that decadence is echoed in the next little bit where we, you know, I'm not trying to jump us ahead, but I think the juxtaposition is interesting, of the fight drum, where you've got all these sleeves designed for entertainment laying around, right? I mean, they've just got display after display of these fight sleeves or entertainment sleeves that are, again, money spent on sleeves that could be used for somebody who can't afford it.
Yeah. And that's a good point, because, and again, the other nice thing about getting Fight Drome is that we get the return of Matt Frewer, and anything with Matt Frewer in it is exponentially better than anything without Matt Frewer. So that leads to a bit of investigating by Ortega and Kovach, because they find out that Bancroft was there the night he was murdered, and Frewer's character, the guy who runs Fight Drome, has the footage of it. Ironically enough, he keeps it on tape. So it makes my...
Because you can't hack videotape.
No, right? It you can't.
Well, yeah.
You can have it get eaten up in the machine, but you can't hack it because it's analog. So there is a perk to having things old school when you need it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons, depending on your perspective. But that moment where the guy who runs Fight Drome, and I don't remember his exact name, but obviously it's Matt Frewer's character, but when Frewer's going around explaining how all these sleeves work, and then they stop at the one and Takeshi looks down and it's his old sleeve that we saw in episode one before he wakes up in Riker's sleeve, that little action sequence at the beginning, that's him in that cube, which has got to be a mind trip to think, I'm looking at an old version of myself.
Yeah, it almost led me to think, and again, we've got a lot of show to go, and we know who plays next season, so I think it's kind of broken, but it had been kind of cool if you could see him get that sleeve back at some point during the run, since we know that eventually they're going to want to bring back the original Riker, right, to have a happy ending.
Right.
So,
but instead of having Chekhov's gun, now we have Chekhov's clone.
Yeah, because is it a throwaway thing, or is it going to lead in something in the next three episodes, maybe? Who knows? But it is kind of, yeah. It's a little too hang a lantern on it kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh,
so.
It totally is. There's no reason why you would go through the trouble of having that moment if that is not going to be utilized later. So at some point, Kovach is going to have to fight somebody who's in that sleeve. Or something is going to happen. That's an inevitability at this point. Because like you said...
Yeah, or all these Fight Club jacked up things come out to fight Ortega and the guys, the girl's father, I forget the guy's name, and Kovach. Yeah, who knows?
Oh, Vernon? Yeah, I mean, Vernon. But like you said, they hung a lantern on it. And if you're going to take the time to hang a lantern on it, that's not going away. That's a plot point that is starting there, and we'll get to it at some point before the end of this first season. But we also find out that Lawrence wasn't alone at the Fight Drome that night, because we see Isaac there. And we also see Isaac get the shit kicked out of him by his dad in a bit of a side fight in the stands while everything else is going on. And that, to an extent, came out of the blue, but it also plays on the conversation that Takeshi had with Miriam earlier in the episode, where she lays it out for him just how ruthless he is, And Takeshi calls her out on and says, you're scared of him.
Yeah, I did think it was a little public, you know, to go against Lauren's image that he tries to project and create to have that encounter in public. But, you know, obviously it helps further the explanation. So
yeah, and to end what we had hypothesized a couple episodes ago, of, yeah, basically, if you're the kid of a meth, you're always going to be the kid of the meth. You're never going to be on your own with your own fortune, your own life. You're just going to be the forever child of the powerful guy and not expected to do anything or have any agency. You're just living your life, you know, whoopee, you know.
Well, and also, there, you're not going to age. You know, Isaac's sleeve is his sleeve. So if you think about it, he could be 65, 70, 80 years old, and he's still in the sleeve of a late teens, early 20s kid.
Because that's where his dad wants him.
How long do you go? Right. So how long do you go before you get really, really tired of looking at that face in the mirror every day when you know that you could be hundreds of years old, but physically you don't age? Again, it would be, it could be different because Bancroft, Lawrence Bancroft, is older. So it could be, from a psychological aspect, a little bit easier to look at a version of yourself and go, well, I'm 300 years old and I'm in the body of a 55-year-old man. I'm in middle age. There's no reason why I look out of place being the way I do. And even Miriam, even though she is, you know, you could argue how much younger she may be than Lawrence, but she's a I would say late 30s, early 40s, approaching middle age, if not middle-aged woman. Still very, very striking and attractive and beautiful, but from a psychological perspective, you can look at that and go, well, I'm a mature human being. So if I live another 250 years in this sleeve, I can accept that, whereas if I'm 300 years old and I look at myself in the mirror and I'm a 12-year-old kid, that's a hell of a mind job. Because after a while, your brain outgrows the fact that you are not supposed to be in that immature of a sleeve, physically, not necessarily emotionally.
Yeah, and to Jason's point, it's like a power thing. It's like there's that family dynamic. You know, like, you know, the dad's older, the kid's younger, so you have that psychological dynamic and, you know, hierarchy that, you know, you are below me, you know, I am in charge, you are the son, you are nobody. You do what I tell you.
And a control mechanism.
Right. And we see how far Isaac is willing to go to buck that control when they go to his house and find the secret room that has, which was an interesting thing, a 3D biological printer. Which, given what we know about 3D printing and how it's evolved in the last 10 years, that's not an unfounded thing. But being able to do it with biological material is more than a little crazy. And I do, there was that little point where Ortega says, do you have any idea how expensive and how illegal this thing is? And it again speaks to the power that the Bancrofts have as a whole, that even somebody as ambitious as Isaac can spare no expense to have that sort of technology at his beck and call to create his own sleeve version of his dad, which we find in the cube next to it. And that allows Takeshi to start putting the pieces together of, well, if Isaac is that driven to be better than his dad or to undo what his dad has done, that he would be able to design his own sleeve of his dad, jump into it, and manipulate business deals behind his back, then how do we know that whoever is in Lawrence Bancroft's sleeve is actually Lawrence?
Right, and he's done it in such a way, whether with outside help funding it, or I think what Ortega had said, where he's maybe selling art that might be part of the family, or maybe his art that he got from his parents, whatever, he's selling that to fund his little enterprise there. So, you know, he's got some, he's not the dumb son that, you know, they're trying to project him as.
No. And you also know that that means that that dynamic is going to come to a head in the next couple of episodes, or at least you hope it does. Again, they hang that much of a lantern on it, you got to get the payoff of it. The question is going to be, is how is that all going to unfold? what's it going to mean for Isaac, what's it going to mean for Lawrence, and what's that going to mean for Takeshi to try and figure out who's trying to kill him. Because right now, Isaac's the front runner.
Yeah, because if he was the one doing the deal in Tokyo when Lawrence thought he was, because he doesn't remember, because he died before he got his memory uploaded, then and the gun only works for family member, you know, for him or his wife or whatever. So if he's in Lawrence's sleeve, same DNA, he could get the gun. He could try to kill his dad to maybe take over as his dad to think, you know, now he's Lawrence, now he's a top dog, maybe, and that didn't quite work out. So now he's, you know. We'll see what happens. But
they've done a good job of lining up the whole family against each other, right? Because you've got the daughter that's going around in the mother's sleeve, which can also open the door. So they're kind of setting the whole family up as everybody has a motive, and now you got to figure out which one.
Yeah, if the kids could take over for the parents by becoming the parents and getting the parents out of the way, and no one, and to what other people's points before, is like, how do I know it's you? Because I see your body, but I don't know what's deck. I have no idea who you are. You know, so yeah, it could work.
Right. And the other issue is that if they tried this by, again, short term, it's not that big a deal. But if they do this long term, they're going to see that it will have the impact on the stack, because the sleeve will ultimately reject the stack. So they would have the exact same problem that Dimmy the Twin had.
Yeah, you might last longer because you're at least genetically, you know, one step off versus jumping to totally different bodies. But yeah, at some point it's not exactly the same, so you're going to start having issues some point down the road. Yeah,
right, which means that if this is what they're ultimately trying to do, that facade is short term, because inevitably they would have to be able to go back to their own sleeves to be able to make sure that they don't have any degradation and be able to carry on with what they're able to do without Lawrence, or even potentially Miriam, even though she's not really a target that we know of so far, to be involved in this. So before we wrap this up, we have to get back to the police station, because they need to find out from Dimmy the Twin how they set up Riker. And again, Ortega, utilizing what she has at her disposal, uses the same guy that she used to sleeve her grandmother in episode 4. And as we already stated, the guy that they cast in that did a really good job this time trying to come off as an Eastern European / Slavic guy, explaining why he's not going to tell them what they want to know. And we see the turning on it, where Ortega's getting more frustrated, and where she stepped in to stop Riker at the beginning of episode 5. Now Riker, or Takeshi, has to be the one to step in and slow her down in episode 5 from killing Dimmy before she can get the information she needs. But that also brings us to where, okay, her boss steps in, they're taking Dimmy out, they get into the elevator, and then you find out very quickly that the Ghost Walker is there, very visible for everybody to see, and that elevator gets messy pretty damn fast with a weapon that I've never seen before, but I would want no part of being on the receiving end of.
Yeah, that's the worst melon baller I have ever seen.
I was thinking of the kind of the same idea. Yeah, that, like, what's the purpose of that thing? But then again, it does some nice damage, so that's at least its only purpose right now.
And the wound is just messy. I mean, there's not much you can do quickly for a wound that looks like that. That's not.
Oh no. It slices, it dices, look at that tomato.
Yeah, it's like your hollow point bullet kind of thing. It just blows out and just does as much damage. Yeah.
Right, and poor Samir, who we haven't really touched on, but he's there at a couple of different points in these two episodes. One, he's chastising Kovach because he's aware of what his presence in Riker's sleeve is doing to Ortega. And he fills Takeshi in on that in a conversation back at the Raven. And then we suspect that he's, you know, he obviously wants what's best for her, and that he was there during the Day of the Dead dinner with Grandma and the rest of the family. But, you know, we also, in episode 5, we see Takeshi and Ortega getting closer, because they end up sleeping together. And we know that, you know, she's torn between realizing that she's looking at her ex-boyfriend, but knowing that her ex-boyfriend isn't in there, and that there is a mutual, I don't want to say a mutual attraction so much as the connection between Riker and Ortega and Kovach and Ortega is starting to galvanize a little.
Yeah, so is it cheating if the body's the same but the mind's different? Just asking. Just,
you know. You could ask Miriam Bancroft and her kids. Exactly, that. Right. I mean, they're the authorities on that, not me. But you know, we get this altercation in the elevator, and now we're left trying to figure out, okay, Samir is dead. And Ortega is in a world of hurt. So,
yeah, that was also one of the few issues I had with this episode was, you know, of all the ways to block the bullet, don't lead with your stack. That just seems like a you know, they could re-sleeve him if he'd gotten killed. They could do anything, but he leads with his stack, and that's what, I don't know. I thought that was a little convenient.
Yeah, because apparently he only had to survive one shot because that's all the gun had for some reason. But anyway, that's, you know, plot armor again, but that's fine. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, that is one where, you know, and you're down to the last 5 minutes of an episode and you've got to get all hell breaking loose in a very small space. I think the way it was choreographed and the way that scene was structured could have been better, but again, it also does take another player off the board in Samir. And again, now we have to figure out what's going to happen with Ortega, because she is really, really fragged. Her stack is probably still intact, but as far as her sleeve goes, she's going to need some serious R&R. And obviously, Kovach has to make sure he can get down to her, or at least get her out before she dies. So, and they've got to figure out what to do about Dimmy the twin, because he was down there too, and the Ghost Walker.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I saw, obviously I've seen this whole thing before, but I've forgotten a lot of the details. But as the Ghost Walker's over Ortega's, you know, prone form, he's quoting like religious verses at her, or religious sounding words to her. So I can't remember all the details, or I'm probably forgetting stuff, but I'm kind of wondering, is this kind of like this age's version of like the Knights Templar? Like, he's like a religious person who's worshiping maybe the myths because they think they're gods, and he's acting out, you know, he's helping them with their, you know, protecting the myths kind of thing, like the Knights Templar did back in the day.
There was the altercation, the interaction he had with the officer earlier where he paid for his drink. And they talked about being a believer, and it's unusual to run into one of the chosen, is how he says it. And so by identifying himself as one of the chosen, he managed to get a police uniform off of him, possibly without, you know, taking it. You know, it might have just been a brotherly assistance there. So it definitely kind of leads to, is there an underground religion operating type thing?
Right. And again, we don't have enough data on the Ghost Walker at this point to really know for sure which way he goes. You know, obviously he is a religious zealot of some degree. To what faith or what belief system or what have you, we simply don't know yet, other than he is antithetical to what Takeshi and Ortega and everybody else are trying to do. And because of that, Ortega is seriously injured, and now we've got to figure out, going in episode 6, how that is going to be resolved. So, in the meantime, what we will do is we will put a pin in that there. But guys, before we go, any last thoughts on episode 4 and episode 5 and what you would like to see going forward through 6 and 7?
No, I mean, obviously this is towards the end, so they've gone through the halfway point. You know, they're starting to get all the plot elements merging together. And, you know, for eight episode season, that's right on target. You know, all been good so far. No real clunkers. So I hope they bring it home.
Well, it's 10 episodes, so
we're actually halfway. All right. I guess season 2 is 8 episodes. Okay, never mind. Yeah, so.
But you're right. It is the halfway point. And I would say it's where we start picking up steam, but to be honest, they've not been slow. So this has been a pretty good paced series, and so I think that if they continue at this rate, it'll definitely burn off real quick and be a satisfying show.
With all these shows, and again, this harkens back to when we were doing the Marvel Cinematic stuff for Netflix, and even when we were talking about Luther, knowing that when you're having compressed seasons like this, knowing that you can't spend a lot of time on exposition, that you've got to make sure the plot is moving at a consistent basis and that all the key plot points are met. And again, we touched on the fact that Vernon doesn't have a lot to do in these two episodes. He's pushed way to the background along with the B-line of what's happening with Poe and his daughter. So they've got to pick that up at some point as well, which I wonder if they're going to get back to that in episode 6 or episode 7. But they can't leave that too far in the background, otherwise we're going to lose interest in it, or they may not find a way to incorporate it before we get to the end of episode 10. That said, we've had the roller coaster ticking up, and we've had a couple of drops with the fight at the Bancroft party and the standoff with Riker and Dimmy the Twins, both of them, and then the standoff with Takeshi and Ortega about trying to understand who Riker is and how that ties into the story as a whole. And now we've got Ortega, who to this point has been fairly indomitable in what she's been able to do, in a situation where her life is at risk, and now Takeshi's got to be the one to go and ultimately save her if narrative tropes carry on as they normally do in stories like this. So now everybody's got to be on the back foot for a little bit and regroup and figure out how they're going to go about what they need to do to solve all this. So, again, we are 5 down. We've got 5 more to go, but we will be back sometime soon, hopefully sooner rather than later, with episodes 6 and 7 of season 1 of Altered Carbon. Until then, I want to thank my guys, Eric Scott and Jason Johnson, for joining me over this last hour. And I am your host, Evan Higgins, and we will talk to you soon. Later. Bye.